עוד פודקאסט? עוד פודקאסט. עוד פודקאסט לסטארט-אפים.
אבי, what's up?
All is good.
All is good. We ready?
I think so.
Okay, let's find out. So, with no further ado, maybe just tell a bit about yourself.
So, I'm Avi Wiesenberg. I originally am from London, born and bred. Moved to Israel, made Aliyah, coming up to nearly 14 years ago. Been involved in high tech for nearly 20 years. Across a range of different companies, everything from corporate to startup. But I am living my best life at the moment in Israel.
Amazing, amazing. And tell a bit about your professional background and what led you to give talks about sales.
So my professional background was I did a business degree and then went and joined Oracle, probably the best sales school, I think, anywhere in the world. Was at Oracle for many years. And then when I made Aliyah, ended up getting into the startup arena. Joined Clicktel, which is now Content Square, in the very early days of SaaS, and have been doing SaaS sales for 15 years, managing teams, building companies, and about 3 years ago went freelance and managed to get some great opportunities, both with you guys and with Intel, mentoring and helping early stage startups, and been loving it.
Mainly focusing on sales and go-to-market, right? Like how early stage startups interact with their clients early on.
100%. So it's really all about helping them get those first deals, helping them understand how to structure their go-to-market, and some of the scale-up companies as well as they start growing.
So what is it that we're going to talk about today?
Okay.
So
we're going to talk about your first sales, understanding sales. I think there's a huge misconception in the market about what sales really is, especially from technical founders who kind of view sales as this scary, dark art subject. And then how to hack your first sales, you know, how to draw that line, how to really get those first deals over the line.
Let's go.
Lovely. So as I said, I'm Avi. Started my career over 20 years ago with Oracle. I suppose I was probably in sales even before that. You know, I used to help my dad sell textiles, schmutters in the East End of London, hardcore sales. Moved to Israel 14 years ago, joined Clicktel that became Content Square, was at Apsi, which got sold to ServiceNow, and Similarweb, probably one of the best known ones. It was there from the journey of 20 million to 60 million, building out their international markets, everything from Japan, China, Far East, Latin America, and everything around there. Was really amazing opportunity to work with Ora and the team at Similarweb, was there for nearly 4 or 5 years. And then I was CRO of Lucia. So that was really my first experience of PLG. Although I would argue that the old freemium days at Clicktel were also somewhat PLG.
Call it differently now, that's all.
Exactly. So I was at Lucia from the journey of about 8 million to 12 million. And then about 3 years ago, started working freelance, helping a range of different startups. Some names you might be familiar with, Voca.ai, GeoEdge, and a few others. And I work now with a syndicate called TeamX, help at the Intel Ignite, help you guys out as well. So working with a range of different companies.
Amazing.
So today we're going to cover off what is sales, what it really is, why someone will really buy. I'm going to touch upon pain and discovery because I don't think it's possible to talk about sales without that, although I know you've deep dived into that with Or. How to understand your ideal customer profile. And I think it's super important for early stage companies to identify that ICP, understand it and understand how they sell to it, and then how to make those first sales. So how to run the line between hacking and being process driven, and also how to navigate complex deals. And I think that's something that becomes really difficult for early stage companies. They get very intimidated when they're dealing with enterprises, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about that and how to navigate that. So I want to start with that perception of sales, that kind of really negative aspect that people have. And this is a picture of Alec Baldwin from a very famous sales film that a lot of people haven't seen anymore, called Glengarry Glen Ross, which was famous for the line of coffee is for closers and ABC always be closing, right? So those lines came from this film, and it was a very aggressive sales culture. And I think over the last 10 years, we've moved away from that. But there is still this perception of sales being, we're just the guys who are good schmoozers. People think we spend our time in the pub with our, with, you know, just wining and dining people. My mum obviously thinks I'm super important. Society, and we'll come back to this, but society views us as dodgy, sketchy, secondhand car salespeople. Mm-hmm. That's the age-old archetypal sales guy, right? Customers obviously think we're there to rip them off. We view ourselves as hunters in the field, you know, herding the cats. And in reality, most of the time we're sat there staring at the CRM, wondering how the hell we're going to hit our quota. I would even go so far, ghosting is supposed to be a new phenomenon. Ghosting has existed for as long as salespeople have existed. Mm. You know, we really have to deal with that. And I think the primary thing we need to look at when we start to understand sales is, why will someone buy? Right. And we have to always ask ourselves that question. Why will someone take that risk of change? And with this, you can go back to that question of pain and understanding the pain and getting someone to do something. But you've really got to have a real motivator, and you've really got to understand the cost of doing nothing. And that do nothing, you know, we meet a million startups and each one, no, I've got no competitors in the space. There's no one doing what we do today. Mm. You still have a competitor. The competitor is do nothing.
Yeah.
Don't bother changing the status quo. You know, no one wakes up, and I break this to companies the whole time. No one wakes up in the morning and goes, do you know what I really want to do today? I want to buy a piece of enterprise software. Like, no one wants to buy enterprise software. They want to make their life easier. They want to solve problems. And if you're not going to help them and alleviate them in terms of making their life easier, they're not going to make their life harder by going through the process of buying you, which especially in an enterprise is a big deal. So this was me about 3.5 years ago, maybe even 4 now. I was 40 kilo heavier than I am today.
Wow.
But what was the motivating factor to make a change? Pain. I was waking up in the morning in pain, and I actually went to an Israeli doctor. I actually don't even remember who he is now. And he took an x-ray on my knee. I was waking up in pain. And he took one look at me, he goes, yeah, you've got, you know, a bit of arthritis in your knee. And I was like, okay, what are we going to do about it? And he like looks at me as if I'm mad. He's like, you're fat, right? If you don't make a change, if you don't do something about this, there's nothing I can do. And that pain is a big, big motivator. And I know you've got a whole masterclass on finding the pain and understanding the pain. What I want to focus on today, though, is understanding the motivator, understanding what you're really selling.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're really selling may not always be what you think you're selling.
Explain.
You may think that you're selling someone the ability to get rid of a pain. And you're going to try and understand that pain and try and understand what they really care about. But the second you build an assumption into that, and the second you don't understand that multiple people will care about multiple things, you may not be selling what you think you're really selling. Mm-hmm. And I want to give you an example, actually, from someone who, going back to this archetypal sales guy.
Yeah, we all appreciate as a good salesman.
Jordan Belfort was a brilliant salesperson. And I think most people have seen The Wolf of Wall Street. And everyone kind of, I actually blame The Wolf of Wall Street now for the fact that in sales interviews, I can no longer ask someone to sell me the pen. Right. And Jordan Belfort got straight to that point, and you see it at the end of the movie. He runs his sales seminar and he says, sell me the pen. And he goes to the next guy, sell me the pen. And they all make the same mistake, right? The mistake is they look at the pen and they go, it's black and it's got color and it writes beautifully and you're going to write amazing things, without doing the primary thing when you're selling, which is to start by asking a question, understand the status quo, understand how you're writing today, what challenges you have with writing, what you're writing, all of those discovery questions about it.
Talk about features of the pain. Of the pen, rather than start a discovery process and ask the right questions in order to know how to properly pitch you that pen.
Correct. And that's already become more well known. What I think isn't is that what you think you're selling is maybe not what you're really selling. And what Jordan Belfort got about selling stocks, and you know, we'll cover it actually, is that he understood what he was really selling. So for those of you who are watching, I think there's going to be a clip pop up
on YouTube.
You can drop in and look, watch this scene. And the scene is going to be this the first sales call that Jordan Belfort does when he joins the investor center. And it's a great scene. You know, Jordan Belfort gets on the phone and he does the great things you're supposed to do in sales. Builds trust, you know, trust me on my winners, and trust me on my losers, not my winners, because I have so few. And by the way, his whole methodology afterwards, you know, I took you in at Kodak at low and I got you out. So you hit them with blue chip stocks, build trust, understand them, and then hit them with the rubbish stocks. But what he was really selling, and I always ask this, if you watch this clip, what was he really selling?
I think he was selling the person the opportunity to pay off the mortgage or make more money.
So he says, you're right, you could make $60,000, you could pay off your mortgage. And the second clip, actually, and there'll be another link in there if you want to watch it, is when he's in the restaurant talking about the first time he talks about Sell Me the Pen. He says, everybody wants to get rich. And they have a whole discussion. The Amish don't want to get rich, but it's irrelevant. Everyone wants to get rich. What Jordan Belfort understood was what he was really selling was not the stock. It was the ability to get rich. It was the ability to be in the stock market. Everybody wants to get rich, yeah. Right? And what you need to understand about your startup is, what are you really selling? What is the real problem you're addressing and what are you really selling? I'll give you an example of it, actually, which I thought was fascinating. Before we get into this element of things that you need to know as you're selling, but understanding what you really are selling. I was working with a company who, amazing company from the Intel Ignite program, who are making microchips, semiconductors in space.
Yeah.
Completely mind-blowing, right? They cool easier, new type of chip technology, super crazy stuff. What did they think they were selling? They think they're selling the ability to have a chip that runs on less electricity and is therefore going to take much less electricity. So when you're building a 5G generator, that 5G antenna will use less electricity.
Yeah.
I said, how do you know they care about it? If you go to the head of BT or the head of Verizon or the head of AT&T who are building it, how do you know they actually care about that? Well, the CFO is going to care about cost, or the company cares about being carbon neutral. So I said, well, how do you know they haven't hedged the cost of electricity for the next 5 years?
Mm.
How do you know that they haven't done a massive carbon offset?
Yeah.
Now, all these things you can find out and you can do the discovery on. And so what they might actually care about, because they're such a large enterprise, is actually the biggest thing for them is 5G coverage. And why have they not got full 5G coverage? Because these things are huge. And if it requires less cooling, you could have a smaller antenna. If you have a smaller antenna, you can put it in more places. Again, so you keep going into different angles. And I think this is one of the most essential parts of sales, is understanding that when the front door is closed, go through the side door.
And find another motive.
You have to find another angle, another way
through. So before even talking about pain and starting a discovery process and then goes on to showing a demo or start actually selling, you say, be very open-minded and have this mindset that I can have different pains that working on different clients for a very specific product with very certain specific features.
And I would go even further for very specific stakeholders.
Yeah.
And even if
you're within the same organization,
within the same organization,
account, the same client.
People are mind blown by this. I very often talk about the number of stakeholders that are involved in getting even a $20,000 deal signed off.
Yeah.
And I always bring them the example from when I was VP of sales at SimilarWeb. I was like, how many stakeholders do you think? And you're talking about at the time the company was maybe 30 million in revenue, 40 million in revenue, 600-700 people company. How many stakeholders do you think I would need to get sign off for to buy a $20,000 piece of sales technology?
Mm.
Right. And some people will go, 5, 6. And I think I can name around 12 to 15 people that would have had to have been involved in some way in getting sign off for that. And if it was above 30 grand, you know, Orfe himself would have reviewed it, yeah, and decided whether we would go ahead with it. So from legal to FP&L to finance to the other stakeholders to sales ops to CISO to whoever it is, right? They're a very, very, very large range. And each of them will have an opinion and can potentially block you for no reason. So you have to bear that in mind and understand that each one of them may have a different underlying motivator that you need to buy. But I think these things hold true for all of them, which is, we sell so people can buy, right? So we're trying to enable that process. We're trying to help them through that buying process. there's the element of transfer of emotion. People buy from people. You can't get away from that. But there is an element of building trust and certainty. And I think this element of trust and certainty is fundamental in the sales process, because the second you do something wrong on that or remove it, you're giving someone a reason not to buy.
Yeah.
And you need to make sure you're helping them buy and navigating them through that process and not giving them an excuse to say no. And the other big element, and I think this is one of the other really massive changes in sales in the last 10, 15 years, is the element of being a specialist in your field. I think in the old days, you were always considered a specialist in your company. So you were the middleman. I was selling Oracle. There's no way the person I was selling to, there was no way I knew more about Oracle database than them, right? Yeah. I didn't know anything about Oracle database. I'm not a techie. What I did know was the internal workings of Oracle. I knew how to get the discounts, how to get the paperwork done, how to do the processes, how to help them through the process of buying internally within Oracle, because that was quite a complex process.
Yeah.
Today, with the advent of SaaS, with the advent of you know, the internet being what it is today, and the way that people expect to buy
more.
Today, yeah. They expect...
Don't just tell me how to get a discount or how to go through the Oracle sales process smoothly, but also teach me something that I didn't know about how your product can help me solve a problem that I was having trouble to solve.
Correct. And I think the problem element was always there. I think people didn't trust salespeople as much, but I also want to re-clarify that, because I think this is one of those misconceptions that people have about salespeople as well. Top-end enterprise salespeople can be paid a lot of money. And I'm sure a lot of founders are sitting there thinking, oh my God, I can't afford this check. Why are these people being paid more than anyone else in the company, etc.? And I met guys at Oracle who were doing, you know, I know the guy who did the biggest deal in Oracle's history at the time that I was there. It was a huge deal with, I think it was with BT. It was with one of the telcos. But in essence, this guy was working the C-suite at this large multinational company and understood the value that Oracle would give to every single part of the business transformation of this customer, as well as someone at the C-suite.
Yeah.
And at that point, why would they not be paid as well as someone on that C-suite?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're holding those conversations, those business conversations with that company at that level, right? And so the specialist in the field, it was there. It was just always at the top end of what was going on. Now it's expected the whole way through, even at a SaaS level.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons why global enterprises would buy. Everything from fixing a problem, as we said, no one got fired for buying IBM, right? It's an old school, big challenge for startups.
Yeah, I have a common problem, so I'll buy the common solution for that.
Correct. But I would balance that with the second to last one on the list, right? Which is today, people are also worried about not being the next Kodak. So they're balancing that aspect of, I have a problem. I'm not going to get fired if I buy IBM. I'm not going to get fired if I buy Salesforce. I'm not going to get fired for just doing what everyone else is doing. At the same time, as a business, and this is, again, one of the biggest changes I've seen probably in the 10, 12 years of selling SaaS. 12 years ago, when you spoke to someone who was the head of, they were in innovation, I would call it, right? It would go nowhere. There was a conversation. They were seen as a nice to have unit, and they couldn't get anything done in the business. Yep. That's changed. Those people now have real budget, real ability to get stuff done in those businesses.
In certain organizations,
depends
for certain
where.
People, there's this change of mindset that I also need to get out of the box, literally, and buy or try something that I don't necessarily think that 100% will work for me, just for, you know, for the slight case that it might will work and solve a problem that I didn't know that
it's exists. It's worth the part.
Or help me innovate in a field where my competitors didn't innovate fast enough. So yeah, for sure. Which goes also for perception and looking good, right?
Correct. And it goes back to that element of, you know, I want to look good. I want to be promoted. I want to try something new. I want that perception as being a forward thinker in the industry. By the way, I see it very often in some of the cyber pieces where you're dealing with CISOs versus OT, you know, you really get some of that downfall where there are a lot of people that are just looking, you know, they're 60 years old, they want their 9-to-5, they just want to sleep at night, versus the CISO who's trying to make a career for himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's a playing to both sides of that in a technology where you've got to play both sides of that coin is quite fundamental as well. And I think a lot of the challenge I've seen in startups with understanding how to sell comes from this founder journey. And I'm sure you're super familiar with this, right? Got an idea, there's a problem, they've been in a job, they're in a corporate, they see a problem. I can fix this. I'm going to go off and make a startup.
Yeah.
Validate it. They chat to 5 people, they chat to 10 people, they chat to 20 people. Yeah, everyone thinks this is a problem. Fantastic. Now I'm going to interview a bunch of people. Everyone goes, love it, love it. Definitely you should invest the rest of your life building this company. You get an understanding there are companies that really need it. Everyone likes it. It's got a big TAM. You then start pitching to investors. Investors like it. They're like, you know what? I agree. This is a big problem, right? I think you've got a solution to a big problem. I'm even willing to cut a check, whatever it is. You maybe even find design partners, early adopters with the problem who go, yeah, I agree with that problem, right? And then you go and find people with the problem and you're selling them the solution.
And this is all different ballgame.
Completely
the last stage.
Completely different ball game. And it leads to what I think is one of the biggest mistakes in early stage companies. You sell them on the problem and the solution that you have been speaking about and working on, maybe not the last 9 months, maybe the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Right. And you're like, yeah, but, and because you've been living and breathing that problem. And not just that, you've been pitching to investors. And when you pitch to the investors care about the macro problem, the TAM. I want to know that this is a generic problem that is big enough for everyone. Instead of pitching the customer what they really care about, what do they really care about?
Something else sometimes.
Themselves.
Yeah.
They only care about themselves. They don't care about, and I see pitch after pitch after pitch that starts with, there's this
client
problem. Client customer sales pitches.
Yeah, they're trying to educate the client about what's going on in the market. Nobody cares.
They only care about what's going on in their company. And it may not be the same problem that you think that you're pitching towards.
Yep.
And you, again, we go back to that. You may not be able to go through the front door. Great. And it's okay to ask that question. You know, we've been speaking with XYZ, who are your competitors, and they keep saying they've got a problem with this and this. Do you also have that problem? And I go, well, not really. Okay, so how are you guys dealing with that? Mm-hmm. So you can ask on the status quo, and then you start questioning around it and try and find other problems that you might be relevant to talk about. But the total problem to the market is not the same as that individual problem, and it is different for each industry that you're selling to, each company you're selling to, each department, and each stakeholder.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's got different aspects. And I think it helps to start asking yourself, what does the customer really care about? Is what you're selling to them, is what you're pitching to them, is it a nice have or a must have?
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, and we found a really big challenge with this in most of the companies I've worked with in the SaaS space. That's really cool. So what? Right? That's really cool. So what question, I think is huge, especially in disruptive technologies. And I'll give you 2 examples of this. Okay. So one of them was with Clicktel. In the early days, right? So for those of you who don't know, Clicktel was it is still Content Square web optimization platform. It understood everywhere someone was moving on a web page. You can see the mouse move, you see heat maps, you see all of that. And to be honest, 14 years ago, when I first saw it and when anyone saw it, they were like, wow, right? Literally, I got demo after demo where people would say, wow. Right, the idea of JavaScript being able to see what you were doing on a web page at the time was revolutionary, even though it's now commodity. And we went demo after demo of hearing wow, and then nothing happened.
Mm.
And we couldn't understand this. Why was no one buying this? Literally, people's jaw drop on the demo, and then we weren't getting deals. And what we realized was 2 aspects on this. Number one, and this is really important to think about, there is always someone who is not in the room. And this is fundamental when you're doing
speaking of stakeholders that should be involved in the sales process.
Correct. There's always someone who they're going to have to tell it to or explain it to, right? And very often it's someone who goes off to have a look at a new piece of technology and then comes back to the weekly meeting and goes, oh yeah, I saw this really cool thing. We can see everyone on our webpage. And the next question that anyone will ask is,
Why would we care?
So what? What do we do with that? Now, we are very lucky at Clicktel. At the time that we were doing this, was the explosion that an industry, in essence, was built at the same time of web optimization. And that web optimization was A/B testing, multivariate testing on the web page. People got jobs that were web optimization managers and needed technology to come up with what they should test and what they should improve and what they should optimize. And we had to build a narrative around that. And by the way, the same thing happened at SimilarWeb, right? Very often you would show someone data. It's always an irony, is like, what's the first web page you go to when you're offered to see any web page in the world? Your own, right? There's a brilliant Michael McIntyre skit about Google Earth, right?
Mm.
You had this ability to see any page, anywhere map. In the whole world, yeah, any
then
map.
You're going to go to your
own house, your right?
It's our house.
Yeah. It's our house. What, by the way, that happens primarily because people want to validate and test and build trust and go, yes, that is what my house looks like. So this technology works, which allows you to then trust it when you go anywhere else in the world. You can validate that it's not bullshitting you. This is really, it's the truth because you can see it. And the same thing happened at SimilarWeb. Then it was a question, well, what do I do with that? No, that was fine because it's marketing data and market intelligence. But again, a primary element of the sales process became, let me go and deal with this afterwards and help you understand how this solves your problems, how you enable someone to use what you're giving them.
Yeah.
My favorite example of this is the Amazon Alexa, by the way. So I wanted an Amazon Alexa back in the early days of it. And my wife is an accountant, runs procurement and all of that sort of stuff. So every spend I have, I mean, it's good. It's good that I have her, otherwise I'd be broke.
The purchasing process in the house is a bit...
Exactly. And I want an Amazon Alexa. She goes, what are you going to do with that? I go, but it's so cool. Like, it can play music and it can do this, it can do that. She goes, you have a speaker. In fact, you have like four speakers. I'm like, no, but it's... Anyway, she blocked it.
Did you get it?
Yeah. Guess when?
When?
Well, it's actually today, no? Amazon Prime Day.
Oh.
Amazon Prime Day, 50% off. I didn't buy one today. I bought it 4 years ago and it now sits and gathers dust. But there are other ways to get a deal done without that process. And one of them, Amazon were very clever with. Perceived value, $300. Discounted value, $150. Even if you're going to use it just as a speaker, it's a reasonable speaker. It's a good speaker. And you've got all the other cool bits with it. So even if you don't use it for its intended use case, it's cheap enough to validate it.
In comparison to other products that do one feature out of many features that Alexa does.
Correct.
Got it.
Just play music.
So we won't sell you the whole Alexa suite. We'll sell you just Alexa as a speaker with some add-ons, and it will cost average.
Same amount as what you would have paid for a speaker.
Yeah, all right, cool.
So I want to go back to that element of how you navigate stakeholders, right? And I think it's an art and a science, but I think you need to understand who you're dealing with. And by the way, I think it's one of the hardest things to do on a Zoom as opposed to in person. It's one of the things I most miss about in-person meetings, that when you turn up at someone's office, you immediately feel much better. You can get a feel much better as to where you are in that deal.
Yeah.
Have they taken you to the conference room? Are they taking you to the cafe? Are they meeting you offsite? Are they bringing in other people? How do other people react when you walk through the floor with them? All of those elements give you a feel as to the kudos and the ability of your stakeholder to get this deal done, right? And I think that's super important.
Can you explain more about that? Because I think you mentioned a bunch of examples that other people that listening to this podcast might be curious about. If they take you to the coffee and hiding you out, that means no good. If they take me to the conference room with the glass windows, it means that I'm good. Like, What is the correlation between those actions to think about the status of the deal?
Okay. So I think it's all about what you're trying to get a read for is how much this stakeholder that you have has an ability to get stuff done.
Mm.
How much self-confidence does he have inside that company? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean whether he's senior or junior. It's purely about his own perception in the company and how much he's willing to, excuse the expression, put his balls on the line for you.
Yeah.
Right. And if he's booking meeting rooms, that's meeting rooms that potentially aren't being used or is more likely to be flagged to his boss, which means his boss is aware of this. The second his boss is aware that you're coming in and that he's spending time on you, then he has to justify that this is a real thing that is worth investing in and spending time going through the process of.
Yeah.
If he's kind of meeting you offsite or in a coffee shop and doesn't want anyone else to see you, it's potentially because he's not yet really sure that he wants other people to know that you're looking at this or that he's seeing it out. So again, it's not, this isn't gospel. It's not 100% either way. You know, I've had plenty of deals where I met them offsite at a coffee shop and I still got the deal. It's just an indicative. It gives you a feeling. You also get to see where his office is, right? Does he have a corner office? And I know all of these things are relatively archaic. We're going back 10, 11 years. But you can see these things on a Zoom as well. What do I mean by that? Can he bring in other people quickly? Does he action it when you say, oh yeah, I want to show this guy about it. Does he then action it or does he ignore you? How quickly is he moving in things? You can sometimes feel the chemistry between those two or three different stakeholders inside the Zoom as to who's leading, who's interrupting, who the real power players are, how interested they actually are in the call. And you need to ask those questions as well. Have you bought anything like this before? Right? Who are the other stakeholders that we need to bring in on this?
Yeah, so this is just to give a bit of a context. So we talked about like what is sales, which is a bit counterintuitive to what we think sales is. Then we went through a bunch of stuff that we need to consider while selling to understand that we sell to the customer, to his own needs, to something that it may be unrelated to the pain that we sold to ourselves. Definitely not the features and the value prop that we tell ourselves that our product is, and definitely not what we told investors. So that's a bit of a wrap up. And then now what I'm hearing you saying is that even before or maybe after or maybe during discovery, when we ask the questions for a specific client about what are his needs, what is like the pain that is coming from, we need to also do a discovery, like a meta discovery on the sales process, which is, I want to sell to you, to Microsoft. So I need to make sure, what are the stakeholders? What's the process? Like you can see in the slide for those watching in over YouTube, how purchases are being made. All those questions, if you can go over them, it's really important. And this is very legitimate. It's almost expected from the other side.
100%.
If he's an experienced buyer, he's expecting you to ask that. The fact that you don't ask what your budget is or who should pay for that or who you're reporting to makes you an amateur, basically.
100%.
And people think that like the Israeli founders that I work with feel like embarrassed to ask. So
I mean, I haven't met many Israelis that are embarrassed to ask anything.
Really?
but yeah, no, I agree with you. I think there's an expectation here. And by the way, they feel it. They know when they're working with an experienced salesperson who knows how to ask these questions in the right way and someone who just ignores them. It's like, well, you're not really leading me through the sale. Again, there's two aspects to the sale which you've highlighted here. One is understanding the fit and building the solution to the fit and selling them on the product. And the second one is navigating the sale. They're expecting you to be the leader and navigate them within their own organization as to how
to control the narrative of each conversation and also on the meta macro level, the whole process.
Correct.
So on a first meeting, when you're meeting someone after you did the outreach, blah, 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 you do discovery, but also through the discovery or before or after, you need to ask those questions.
Yeah. And listen, not all of them are going to happen straight away. Like you're not going to ask them from the beginning, like, are we going to speak to procurement before they've agreed that
No, of course, you don't get into the conference room for the first meeting with the first person and then you get in, you sit on a chair, you say, hi, how are you? Talk a bit about golf and then ask him, okay, so tell me who you are reporting to. No, but these are stuff that you should figure out through the call, through 100%. The process.
And you can ask them, like, what department do you sit in? Who does that roll up to? More as a general, like, let's understand how your organization is structured because...
Let me learn more about
you. You're learning. And that curiosity, by the way, I know I quote Ted Lasso on it, but be curious is like, it's absolutely essential for sales.
Definitely.
So I think it goes back to that discovery versus selling, right? It's that curiosity, roles and responsibilities, what strategic initiatives, what external challenges, understanding that status quo. All of those elements are super, super important. And by the way, that discovery is even easier to do now with LinkedIn, all the public information, especially if you're selling to large enterprises, their strategic initiatives are out there. You can read them and you can tie to them. And that gives the person you're selling to that extra element of kudos as well, that they're that they can tie to the strategic initiatives that are going on. I'm not going to focus too much on this, but I think understanding that status quo, right, is all part of that discovery and pain analysis.
Going back to discovery. When you mean status quo, by the way, it's not just a political term. It's like understanding what my client environment looks like, emotionally, mentally, practically, tech stack, budget, everything.
Exactly. You're in essence, your job of selling technology is you're moving them from how they do something today to how they're going to do it with you tomorrow.
Which is change that people hate.
And you can't make a change.
Hate because they hate change.
Everybody hates change. No one wants to change. No one will, goes back to the beginning. No one will make a change just because they want to. But you cannot get them to make that change unless you understand what the current status is.
Exactly.
And I think that's very, very key to building it.
And here I'll just add something and correct me if I'm wrong. Don't assume. Even if you talked with a bunch of clients about that discovery, it's not just about finding out what you don't know, but also make the other side kind of like articulate in his own words and even remind himself what his current status is and what he would like to change.
I agree with you. And I would go even further on it. Like it's that current status that you're analyzing or making them articulate is goes back to perception.
Yeah.
Because it may be really, really bad situation, but if they don't perceive it as bad, they won't make a change.
Yeah. And you won't be the one to convince them. No, but it's
they
bad
need
for
to
you.
Convince themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
That change has to come
by
from
answering
within.
Your questions.
I mean, it goes to an element that
sometimes or mostly even. Yeah,
100%. I mean, it goes to a methodology that I had, but I don't think we're going to have time to touch on, which is spin. Spin methodology is still my number one basis level in sales.
Give us a few highlights about it, because this goes all back to the wrapping up of the episode, which is like starting from sales, understanding the motives, understanding the pain,
100%.
Talking to clients differently than you talk to other stakeholders within the company or outside the company, doing discovery, controlling the sales process, understanding the narrative, figuring out that what's cool for you, it's not necessarily cool for the client. Wrapping up all of that, give us a few maybe practical hands-on tools to do that as salespeople or early stage founders who want to start their first sale.
So I would say three things. Number one is go and read Spin Sales by Nick.
Spin, S-P-I-N?
S-P-I-N.
All right.
By Neil Rackman. Okay, it's a great book. You can probably just YouTube some videos on it as well. Spin was developed, and it's funny because we'll go back to the first slide. It goes back to the dodgy, sketchy secondhand car sales guy. Huthwaite was the organization. They were brought in by Mercedes-Benz. Mm. Mercedes-Benz said, our top 20%, Pareto's law, is all in. Top 20% of salespeople bring 80% of the sales year after year after year. What are they doing differently to everybody else? And Huthwaite came in and analyzed Mercedes-Benz salespeople, and they saw that it wasn't about the talk, by the way. Ironically, everyone thinks sales guys are good schmoozers. It was all about the questions they were asking. And it's the primary difference between a good sales guy and a great sales guy.
The amount of questions, the type of questions?
The type of questions, okay? And they narrowed it down to four types of questions, which they defined as spin, which is situation, pain, impact, and needs payoff. Okay? And situation is what we talk about, status quo, which leads to a pain. Okay, that's how you're doing it today. What's the problem with that? Impact, what is the impact of that pain? What does that mean? Yeah. What happens because of
this
that
This is what
pain?
The salespeople articulate as questions to the client. They didn't Correct. Explain to them. They asked.
They let it just drop in their head.
All right.
Which is where, again, we go back to that perception of salespeople, in essence, being masters of a dark art of influence and getting people to do what they want.
Yeah, but I think that for a lot of people, it's still counterintuitive. And that's why a lot of these playbooks are needed, because people think that salespeople just sell. And by selling, we have the intuition that they talk a lot and they try to sell you on to something, while you're actually selling that to yourself.
It's 100% the opposite. You're not going to schmooze someone into buying something. You're going to have to let them and ask the right questions to them. And I'm talking about primarily, there's still the emotional element of it. But
hate you, they probably won't make a deal.
No
we
one
need
buys
to be
something
likeable.
For someone they don't like. But your way of connecting, and I think not to drop another book on it, but Daniel Pink, who's written some great books, including Drive and Time and Regrets. My favorite book of his is To Sell as Human.
Wait, but I'm trying to keep you centered. The spin one. So you said situation,
pain,
which are the type of questions that are more discovery related.
The
questions.
Discovery lesson. But what is the problem with what you're doing today? What is the problem that's going to come around from mm-hmm. that? Impact. So that's great. You've told me that your knee hurts. Okay. You do it as a doctor even, right? Okay, what's the situation? My knee hurts. Okay, where's the pain exactly there? Okay, what's the impact of that pain? It means I can't run. Okay, so if I could fix the pain and then you could run, what does that mean for you? Mm. Well, it means I'd be happier. It means I can live my life, whatever it is. Yeah. Whatever you want to then achieve.
Yeah, which make me as a client articulate to myself, I'm already dreaming of myself, of my life with a fixed knee.
Correct. But so take it to a business context, it goes even further. It's like, if I can give you 2 more hours in the day, what does that mean for you? And the needs payoffs can be to the business, to the individual's family life, or it can even just be, look, I'm going to get the promotion because the needs payoff is this is we're going to be a more digital, this is going to get on the CEO's desk. Okay, yep. What's the impact of that for you? And what's the impact of the needs payoff for the company as well? So it's a great basis methodology, which was the core, I think, of solution selling. And solution selling has been around for a long time already. I mean, Huthwaite developed this back in the 80s. SaaS has changed it a little bit because SaaS allows the trust element to be built more easily. And I think trust is very, very important within the sales process. Mm-hmm. It hasn't gone away for anyone. And that trust comes from being clear and being making sure that you're having a clear message the whole way through.
Yeah. So that's been.
That's
been. Did we touch enough the last part, the N one?
Needs payoff. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just that element of, again, the penny drops to the customer. Mm. They themselves are going, oh yeah, if I did that. I mean, and by the way, very often.
If I did that, if I fixed my knee, I could run. And if I could run, I feel amazing. If I feel amazing, I'll spend a lot of less money on surgeries and stuff. Oh,
I'll give you the example I always give, which is a non-tech business example. I actually quite like explaining to people how this can be done non-tech. I usually do an oil candle sales guy, right? When I teach spin, I go back to you're selling oil candles to a restaurant that uses wax candles, okay? But it's more expensive. So what's the needs payoff? Well, you can't build the right needs payoff until you've understood status quo and discovery and situation, which may mean they want to expand to more restaurants. So what's preventing them? Don't know. So then you go into pain. Well, it's staff. They can't get enough staff. Okay, what are the staff doing? All sorts of different things. What's the impact of not having staff? I can't expand. I'm spending too long. What are the staff doing? Well, and then you ask direct questions about what you're selling. So how do you change the wax candles? Well, the staff have to do it every day and they have to clean it out and they have to do this. So if I could remove that problem and give the staff an extra 2 hours a day, what would the impact of that be? And you can lead them as well. So you can say, well, do you think that it would make them happier because they're doing less menial jobs? Or do you think you could, you know, it would improve the morale?
The art of asking questions. You really experienced that now with our little chat here.
Yeah.
So let's go over back to the slide and move on with the pace.
So, So we'll move on to the key, I think, within this as well, is the way that you ask these questions. And it is a real challenge because a lot of people will go through a tick box, right? They'll just list off question. And you can't do that. It has to be a natural conversation. It has to flow. And it has to be part of that curious element. But I think I want to go back to that element of building trust, okay? And I think this is fundamental. Even as you're doing spin or any of these methodologies, you have to build trust at every step of the way. And one of the best ways of building trust, by the way, is storytelling, right? I'm not the world's best storyteller. I think, you know, Yuval Noah Harari, I think, nails this when he says, you know, sapiens rule the world because we are the only animal that can cooperate flexibly. And this mysterious glue is made of stories, not genes.
Communal beliefs.
Yeah. It's that element of conveying something in that story essence. And I think Daniel Pink, who I mentioned just before, I think he nails this, right? He redefined in this book, To Sell as Human, he says, any conversation you have, anytime you want someone to do something
with you, always sell.
You're selling, right?
Selling ideas.
You want me to come and do a podcast, you're selling,
yeah.
Right? So everyone's
it's not just
selling.
For an exchange of money. It's for
exactly.
everything.
Everything. Everything yeah. is sales. And in order to sell, and I think it's a lot of things that's missing today, in especially in the environment we're in, is that element of attunement. Okay. We cannot get out of our own heads and see things from someone else's point of view and find the common ground. In essence, customer-centric selling. Yeah,
which is what we should have.
We have to find that empathy. You have to go, if you want to sell the customer a new system, and by the way, this comes back to the status quo. The customer isn't going to believe him when I say, my new technology is going to change your life, if he doesn't believe that I understand him. Right? And
First thing first. That's what
100%. And by the way, this applies to anything. Goes back to Huthwaite and the spin sales. The number one difference between a good sales guy and a great sales guy is you walk into the showroom to buy a car, a bike, anything that has even the slightest bit of, I wouldn't say customization, but choice involved. They go, what are you looking for today? As opposed to, who are you? The second they go, oh, you were looking at that car. Let me tell you about that car. What have you done? You've done the classic feature bashing, right? Oh, you were looking at this Mercedes. Let me show you this Mercedes. Instead of saying, what do? Where do you drive? What car do you drive today? What sort of car are you looking for? How many kids do you have? What would you be interested in? I want, a two-seater convertible. Now, if I knew you just got divorced, I might know why you want a two-seater convertible.
Mm.
And that allows me to think of other elements that might be more attuned to you because of what you're trying to achieve with the car that you're buying, right? Go back to it, the same element with anything that you're trying to sell. You've got to understand them. They've got to believe that you understand them properly in order to then sell.
Yeah.
The second one he says is buoyancy. Buoyancy, I think we all know in sales, is brutal, right? You're going to keep getting knocked down. You're going to have to keep bouncing up. I think it's the same tendency we look for in founders, same element. The last one, and I think is the most essential, is clarity, especially in today's sales world where everything is online. So if you have a website that says, this is the latest and greatest technology for enterprises, and then you get on a sales call to an SMB and go, this is perfect for SMBs, they're going to look at your website. And the second you've got that mismatch of
information, misalignment of what you're saying to what has been written in your website, you're done.
You're dead.
Yeah.
Deal's over. You've given them an excuse not to buy. Now,
this goes back to microcopy, storytelling.
All of it. And
using the precise words that will describe what you're doing. People, early stage founders don't know how to do that. They're focusing on the features or on buzzwords rather than on the real value prop.
The real value pop and the real element that you're curating information today. Now, that being said, with clarity, and I want to touch upon this, early stage founders do have the benefit in a way that there isn't that much written about them online.
Yeah.
They don't have 1,000 reviews on G2 Crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And people are trying to understand what they're good for, or where they're good
yep.
for. And that goes back to the Jordan Belfort argument of, well, I can say what I want, right? I can say that this is a big company and my secretary and everything else.
Yeah.
And by the way, it doesn't even need to be a small company that does that. Big companies can do that as well. Perception is key. Now, I want to be very clear with this because I'm not saying to lie and I'm not saying not to tell the truth because that will come back and bite you. What I am saying is that there's a difference in perception, right? And you have to build trust at every stage. Now, if you lose sight of the lies you're telling, you will get caught by them. But I don't think it's lies. I think what you can do is bend the truth because the other side doesn't necessarily know this. This goes to pricing, for example. And I'll talk you through one of my first Clicktail deals. I was fresh out of Oracle and I was in an 11-man startup in the Bursa in Tel Aviv. Mm. And we just launched the enterprise version.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, no one knew what that was. We hadn't built any packaging to it. And I get the first client who's the prospect because they're using quite a lot. And the SMB version of the product's not working for them.
Mm.
And they go, will it work? Will the enterprise version work behind the firewall? I've got no idea, right? I'm literally 2 weeks into the job. I say, I need to check on this, but I definitely think it should. Let me go and confirm everything. And I go and check with the support guys and they're like, of course it should. The SMB version works behind a firewall. They've obviously got something wrong with their settings.
Mm-hmm.
I go back on the phone. I go, 100%, the enterprise version works behind a firewall. They go, great, we'll buy two websites they needed. Now, I would have given them a package with three websites on the enterprise version. Mm-hmm. Immediately, I've just sold two, right? So it's all an element of perception, of holding back, of making sure it's logical. And by the way, that was very important because it meant we couldn't, and this is one of the reasons why people don't put their enterprise pricing on the website. There's a change to that because from a PLG standpoint, it's easier. You want to be as transparent as possible. And I agree with all of those elements of transparency. But there's also something where the customer needs to feel they're getting a good deal, right? I'll give you an example, and I still use it. Everybody has a boss. There's always another bad guy, and it's usually their lawyer. But you always want to look for an excuse to either hold off or wait for another approval or whatever it is. And that's possible even when they know they're speaking to the CEO, because you still have a boss.
Yeah.
You've got a board. They don't know that the board is you and your co-founder. You've got a board. I've got a pricing committee. And I've used pricing committees even in big negotiations where it was me and the CFO on a call.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, listen, we think we can do that discount. We need to take it to the pricing committee. They go, okay. We hang up the phone. And we are the pricing committee, me and the CFO.
Yeah.
But it's still a pricing committee. And I don't think it's wrong to do that. I think it's a
matter of optics as well.
Correct. It's optics and it's perception, and it gives them the confidence that they're getting the best deal they can. Again, there has to be a logic. There has to be a clarity. There has to be a consistent message the whole way through, because otherwise you're going to ruin trust. And I think that logic has to go through all of your pricing, the meter, the cost, the value, everything you're doing on that. And you have to believe in it. You have to believe that story yourself more than anyone else. And I think the belief is super, super important. The last thing, I don't know how much time we've still got, building trust. And I think this is one of those fundamental pieces. There are a lot of different ways of building trust in the sales process. The empathy, the understanding of the customer, that will all help you with the sale. POCs. Super important. I get a ton of questions about POCs, trials, money back, monthly, just doing this a month.
Versus the annual.
Correct.
Yeah. You can leave any month you want.
References, clients' calls, reducing the friction. But all of these things, I think one of the most fundamental.
Very important slide. For those of you who are not YouTube in it, go see this slide about building trust. A lot of actual ideas for what you can do in order to sell, make the first sale better to your client.
And I think, early stage startups need to remember that it's not the end of the world that you're a 5-man company, right? I think that's changed. I used to be very wary of that.
People assume now that the software that they're buying is not just Salesforce or IBM.
Correct. But what they do want to do...
In the world of SaaS disrupting, correct. You know...
100%. But they do want to reduce the risk, right? Now, for a big company, spending $20,000 on a piece of software, the risk, let's be very, very clear about it, the risk is not the cash.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very rarely the amount of money you're asking on the sticker. The risk is them building their business on it.
Yeah. If it's a workflow application, I'm building all my business on you and then you got shut down. Yeah.
That's a real disaster, right? The risk is the opportunity cost of not going with something else. The risk is the speed that this doesn't work, that we don't implement. There are a lot of other risks, and you need to reduce the risk and the friction at each one of those. Again, goes back to curiosity. You want to try and understand, where do they perceive the risk? Why are they saying no? Jordan Belfort actually has his own methodology called the straight line method, where his number one thing is get to a no as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then try and understand why they've said no, and then knock down every single reason that they've said no so that they have to say yes, right? But again, POC is a very good way of doing it, because you're going to, but you need to understand, is this a value POC or a technical POC?
Yeah, people just say, I'm having a POC. Why do you want to get out of it?
Correct.
In 3 months from now, you will say it was a successful POC. How? What would be the metrics, the core North Star metrics that determined that this was a successful POC?
And by the way, it's really interesting, because on POCs, I usually ask people, what would you prefer, a value-based POC or a technical POC? And they usually say, well, value, right? And I go, no, I much prefer a technical POC, because it's binary. If it works, we close, we're done, it worked. if it didn't work, it didn't work. I need to fix it to the point where it works. But the second it works, you're buying it. Yeah. It's no longer subjective. It's an objective POC.
For the founders, for the startup.
For the startup.
Yeah, of course.
For the customer, the second you're in a value base,
it's a matter of perception. No, I uplift myself in 20%. It's not enough.
Not
value.
Enough.
Yeah.
So value-based POCs can be really difficult. And I think when we look at the funnel, this is actually from Winning by Design, SaaS Sales Blueprint. You know, the old funnel was very, very simple. You navigated someone through the funnel. You held all of the information and you navigated through the funnel. Today, the funnel's all over the place. And very often you only speak to someone after they've done all their research, right? So they're already at this point where they've done a load of education and then they select and you've got land and expand and you've got to continue nurturing them and educating them. And it goes backwards and forwards within the funnel. And that's why you really have to work at building trust at every stage of this, that you keep that clarity throughout the entire process, because you've got to be consistent with your messaging and you've got to try and reduce and think about how do you build trust at every single stage in this, whether it's webinars or podcasts or blogs, whether it's how you do a freemium or a free trial or whatever it is, you have to work through that process the entire time in building that. But going back to POCs, you know, we were saying value versus technical, paid versus unpaid. What are the success criteria? You know, I would much rather, by the way, always do a POC that is a roll forward contract. So actually it's a 13 or 15 month contract with a break clause at 3 months.
Yeah.
So we're all in. And by the way, this is one of the biggest challenges I had with freemium or PLG, right? And I'm going back to my Clicktail days now, right? But it was like, well, we're offering a skimmed down version for freemium or for $5 a month.
Mm.
Okay, it's great. It works. What happens at the end of that? It worked. I don't need anything more.
Yeah.
I got what I needed from the $5. So unless your meter is absolutely spot on, that you're going to force them to buy the enterprise afterwards. But then the perception is, well, I can use the $5 product. Or the other side, it didn't work. Well, no, because it didn't work because you need the enterprise version. Then
nobody likes to hear that.
You're out. You've lost. You're dead at that point.
Yeah, anyway. So you need to give enough value for them to want to buy more. But don't expose everything at the beginning.
Correct. You need to get your meter absolutely correct. And it's not always easy to do that. And don't forget, the other thing I would just add on that is a POC is not a design partnership. Mm-hmm. Right? They're very, very different things, design partnerships, and the expectation is different. And I think that's another thing that's changed massively, I think, in the last few years in Israel. As we got bigger companies, scale-up companies, they became amazing design partners and they leveraged the ecosystem here as well to nab early stage companies to help them with whatever they were doing and became really good design partners. But people haven't always been that good at converting them or turning them into actual paid POCs. And you have to remember, POC and design partnership, two different things.
Two different things.
Completely different things. Design partnership, you bring them on early, you're asking in return that they lead you.
Build the product with them. It's not a real sales process. POC is part of the sales process. Let's
very clear.
Make a trial for the tech, for the performance, for the value. And if it works, you pay as a client. You don't get a special treatment, quote unquote.
Correct. Straight out.
Yeah.
Last thing I'll leave you with is that building urgency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is that element of how do you get the deal actually closed? You know, we said getting a no is the start of the deal. Understanding the urgency at their end. It's not always easy. When's your budget cycle? When do you want to get this live for? When do you want to have the impact? Not always easy. False urgency works. It's a shady sales technique. And it doesn't always work. If the deal's not ready to be done, it's not ready to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to understand whether you can build a false urgency or not. And you can always blame someone else. Look, I'm not going to be able to keep this price next quarter. I know we talked about this. And by the way, there's other things you can do to build false urgency, right? I've got resource right now to help you. I can give you this. I can get it live for you. I can move you up in the order in terms. They know you're a smaller
company.
You can
use that in every stage of the sale. You can also say, now I have room for 3 design partners, for 4 POCs.
Exactly.
And then as time move on, hopefully you made real progress in the world, traction business-wise, then you really fulfill your promises on a you know, somewhat of a negative tone even. I'm sorry, like we don't have more rooms for POCs. We now only accept like full paying clients.
And it goes 100% back to that element of perception that they don't know everything that they don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
right? And you can leverage that to your advantage. Again, it's not an element of being the shady secondhand car sales guy. It's a case of saying, actually, it's true. And you need to believe it. It's like, if I get another customer now who I'm going to prioritize them ahead of you. So
definitely at an early stage. Okay. Yeah.
And we talked about spin. This is a copy of the book.
Yeah.
Last thing I would leave you with is the sales stack,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's got mental out there, right? It's not quite as bad as the marketing sales technology stack yet, but it's getting there. There are a lot of different technologies vying for your attention, even as an early stage startup. I would go with four main pillars that you need as soon as you start selling. And by the way, I'm surprised with how many early stage companies who are already doing founder sales calls and all of that.
Aren't using those.
And are not recording their calls. Just recording your calls from a training and intelligence standpoint at the bottom. And there's loads of others. There's Novacy. There's a bunch of other tools at the bottom end. Even just hit record on Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, it is fully acceptable now. You ask the customer, do you mind if I record it for note taking or whatever it is? Record the call and it allows you to analyze it afterwards. And one of the tricks, and we go back to that question that you asked before, you know, when you're in the in-person meeting and you're reading signals, okay? I'll go back to this. I always like to have someone else on the sales call with me.
Yeah.
Why? Because I need that second to think. Because we spoke about before, the number one issue is not speaking.
It's listening.
Listening and asking the right question. And the second I give someone else on the call, even if it's just to talk about something else, or I say, oh yeah, our pre-sales is just going to show you how that bit works.
Yeah.
Gives me a minute to digest, think about the other things that they've told me earlier, and just ask that one more deep dive question that I didn't ask before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's super important, and trying to read between the lines of what they have said or haven't said, which you only get when you listen back to the call sometimes. So I think those are very important. CRM, obviously, you need something to keep track of it all. If you're doing outbound, you need something for engagement. You can try and do a lot of that yourself. I mean, I haven't even added in the AI stack that you can build.
Yeah, you can do that manually as well.
And the outreach, and LinkedIn and everything that goes around that. So that's kind of my core overview of it. But I think really, you know, the three pillars I would say is that element of asking the right questions and being curious, of understanding that what you think you're selling may not be what you're really selling.
Yeah, and try to figure out what would be the thing that your client want, that the other side want.
What they really want, and then making sure you keep consistency and clarity through your messaging as you go through it, so that even if you do Ben's perception, you make sure that you're consistent with it as you go forward.
Amazing. I think that's pretty much sums it up. Avi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Guy.
חברות וחברים, תודה רבה שנשארתם עד סוף הפרק והאזנתם לי. אני מקווה מאוד שהפרק העשיר אתכם ולימד אתכם משהו חדש, ואם הרגשתם שלקחתם משהו מהפרק הזה, אני ממש אשמח שתשתפו אותו ואת הפודקאסט בכלל, כדי שעוד יזמות ויזמים בתחילת הדרך בישראל יוכלו ללמוד על איך להקים ולהתחיל את הסטארט-אפ שלהם. אם אתם רוצות ורוצים לשמוע עוד פרקים, אני מזמין אתכם להירשם למעקב. כל הלינקים למעקב אחרי הפודקאסט שלנו מופיע בדסקריפשן, וכמובן אתם מוזמנים לפנות אליי או בלינקדאין או באינסטגרם ולספר לי איך נהנתם מהפרק ומה למדתם, או סתם לכל בקשה ותהייה, גם הלינקים האלה מופיעים אצלנו בפודקאסט. תודה רבה ונתראה בפרק הבא.